Good afternoon, members and the members of the public. I call this meeting on Human Services Finance Committee to order. With that, I just wanted to recognize we have a quorum present. I would like to entertain a motion to approve the minutes for February 7th, 2023. Representative Hicks, do you move the approval of minutes for February 7th, 2023?
Yes, Chair. I move the approval of the minutes.
Representative Hicks moved the approval for minutes for 2023, February 7th. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Seeing none, the minutes for February 7th, 2023 are now approved. With that, members, we have three bills today, and we'll like to keep it on time, so every bill will receive at least 30 minutes. And with the first bill, I would like to welcome Representative Beerman. It's House File 564. I would like to move that House File 564 be re-referred to the Education Finance Committee. Please welcome to the committee. Introduce your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members, for the opportunity today. I'm not sure, Mr. Chair, if we need to move my amendment to the bill.
Yes. You have an A1 amendment. I would like to move A1 amendment for the bill. Any
Thank
discussion
you.
On the A1 amendment?
This basically, Mr. Chair, basically it's just changing the title of the contracting agency.
Good. Discussions, members? None. All those in favor of approval of A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment A1 is now adopted. With that, to your bill as amended, Representative Beerman.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members again. Just a bit of background. The school-linked behavioral health services grant funds were part of the governor's mental health initiative passed by the 2007 Minnesota legislature. The goal was to eliminate the barriers to accessing treatment and completing treatment plans, which included the inability of parents to take off work every week for 20-plus weeks, transportation issues, especially in greater Minnesota, poor insurance or no insurance, and difficulty navigating the mental health system. The grants are provided to community mental health providers who co-locate in the schools. They diagnose and treat children and work with parents and teachers to support the child. They can bill public and private insurance. Treatment is not limited to special ed students. There's also a firewall between the health care and education records. The professionals can see the child in their own milieu and work closely with the school support personnel. Funds are used for children who are uninsured and underinsured and for services for which you cannot bill insurance. It is a highly successful and well-loved program. To truly help all our children, we need to make sure this program is available in every school building. Funding is included in the governor's budget and is strongly supported by the Mental Health Legislative Network and educators. Mental health issues are diverse. This bill will help kids with issues of stress to substance use disorder and everything in between. And members, I just want to add a personal story. I've only been in the legislature a few years. One of the meetings that had the most impact on me was to meet with the school counselors within a senior high in my district. And I met with them, discussed their work, and they described their role in the Office of Counseling as a clinic. But in the middle of this clinic is an emergency room. And that's what they deal with every single day. Kids who come in the office, they need help now. And I counted the counselors and I divided the school numbers by the counselors, and it was about a 1-700 ratio. So we have a lot of work to do to get to where we can deal with the issues our kids are facing. Right after that visit, I went to an elementary school, and I spoke with a teacher for about 30 minutes about issues in her classroom. And we talked a lot about public education and what she's what she's dealing with. But at the end, I asked her, what is your most significant challenge? What's the number one concern you have? And without hesitation, she said, the mental well-being of my students. This is a 20-year veteran of school education. And the big thing here now, members, is that these conversations occurred before COVID. So the need is greater than ever before for this legislation, and I hope you will support it. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Representative Bierman. To the first testifier, I have Sue Abdeholden. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Sue Abdeholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, National Alliance on Mental Illness, and also representing the Mental Health Legislative Network, a coalition of over 40 organizations dedicated to building our mental health system. I was involved in the very first legislation back in 2007, and I need you to know that this program is frankly the best thing since sliced bread. You can talk to any parent, any teacher, principal, and they will all say that the presence of mental health professionals in the school has had a positive impact on both the students' mental health and their academic success. The symptoms of a mental illness impact a student's ability to concentrate, remember, and more, and it impacts them both socially and academically. This program has helped students in all parts of the state, rural, suburban, and urban. And I think what's really important, having come to you nearly every year to get more funding for this program, is it has always enjoyed bipartisan support. It didn't matter whether it was Democrats or Republicans. Everyone has really supported this program because they've seen the impact in their own communities. And I will have to say that now more than ever, we need to be increasing access to mental health treatment and services for our children and youth. The CDC reported that 37% of high school students reported poor mental health. 44% reported being sad or hopeless. 26% reported suicidal thoughts, and 12% attempted. Children have been through a traumatic time for all sorts of reasons. And so we need to help these children understand and cope with what they have gone through. And if they're struggling with their mental health, they will struggle to do well. They won't do well in school and in life. So it's really important we address their needs. And I just want to say that if you think about what we call kind of the PBIS triangle, that there's a lot of things we can support the kids on the bottom, right? Small things. The kids in the middle are the ones who the school support personnel, the counselors and the social workers really help. And the kids at the top who need actual treatment are the kids that are being served by this program. So I urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Sue Abdeholden. And the next person on the list is Lisa Shaw. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lisa Shong. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist and the clinical director of Change Inc., school-linked mental health program. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to speak about school-linked mental health today. School-linked mental health has increased accessibility to some of the most disadvantaged communities who are least likely to access mental health services. Barriers that families experience are language, cultural, economic, transportation barriers. Students and families who are uninsured, underinsured, or not insurable, and caregivers who have their own mental health challenges. School-linked mental health is responsive to these barriers. School-linked mental health expands beyond just the school setting. We also reach and extend our arms out to the community and homes of students. We go where children and family are. My colleagues and myself have sat in many living rooms, homeless shelters, libraries, and parks, engaging a whole family in a student's care. Most importantly, providing culturally responsive school-linked mental health services means the clinician understands the culture and the language of the student and family is at the forefront of their work. In a perfect world, we would have an abundance of clinicians who look like our students and speaks their language. This area of SchoolLink Mental Health is in need of innovation and partnership with cultural communities that represent the students. In addition to increased access, SchoolLink Mental Health clinicians collaborate with the school to encourage students and school staff to view mental health in a healthier way to reduce stigma. Students learn that you are not the only one. Your caregiver is not the only one. It's a validating and normalizing experience. It makes it okay to talk about mental health. This is a story of how SchoolLink Mental Health and school partnership has made a difference in the lives of students and their families. At one of our schools, students witness their bus driver getting shot on their way home. There were three children on the bus, all under the age of 10. The oldest, with a very heroic heart, told the students to get on the floor, to not look, and proceeded to shield them with his body. Early the next morning, the school principal reached out to our SchoolLink therapist for help in offering mental health support to the children and their families. Within the hour, our agency were able to rally a group of Spanish-speaking therapists to meet the parents and the three children in a reflective group healing process. Our SchoolLink staff used play therapy tools to help the children feel safe and at ease and invite them to share anything they wanted to about the incident. And the children shared their memories, fears, curiosities, and needs. Both children and caregivers left feeling seen, supported, heard. A wise mentor of mine said, children belong to families, and families belong to community. I believe that day proved true to that statement. Thank you again for this opportunity, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you, Ms. Chung, for your testimony. Appreciate the work that you do. The next person is Kim Lewis. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Kimberly Lewis, and I represent Minnesota's 333 school boards across the state. I'm really pleased to offer full support to Representative Bierman's bill to expand children's school-linked mental health services. From around the state, we hear from school board members that students are struggling with their mental health. This is not just an urban or suburban issue. Greater Minnesota, too, has students who are struggling. To address their needs, we need to look at building comprehensive school mental health systems, which includes partnering with community mental health agencies. Students who have good mental health are more likely to engage in school, develop healthy relationships, and be connected to adults. It's what we all want for our students. Not surprisingly, like many other areas in healthcare, there is a workforce shortage for mental health professionals. This shortage is impacting school districts as well. Working for a school-linked mental health agency has different challenges than working in a private pay environment. Because of limited funding and competitive grants, some providers, even though they are doing great work, could lose the grant and then those relationships are damaged, or they could lose the amount of funding and then not be seen as many children. Minnesota's school-linked mental health program is a national model. Early diagnosis and evidence-based treatment has led to a decrease in suspensions, reduced office referrals, and better mental health outcomes for Minnesota students. We should build on this success and work towards having school-linked mental health services in every school building. To get there, we need programs like school-linked mental health grants. Having mental health professionals in the school who can collaborate with the teachers, school staff, and school support personnel simply leads to better outcomes. These grants make it possible for children to get diagnosed and treated. Schools that have these programs report the positive impact it has on students, families, and the school community. But the program is not in every school building, and many programs have waiting lists by late fall. The needs among our students are great. This bill helps fulfill those needs. MSBA has a legislative policy or position that the legislature should provide dedicated, ongoing financial resources for mental health in schools. In recent years, the school-linked mental health grants have served our students well, and this system is tried and true. Consistent funding for school-linked mental health is necessary not only to ensure services are available to all who need them, but to ensure staff pay is competitive. Ask any principal or superintendent what they worry about most right now, what keeps them up at night, and they'll say the mental health of our students. I urge you to increase the programs or the fundings for these programs. Thank you so very much.
Thank you so much for your testimony, Ms. Lewis. I appreciate the work that the Minnesota School Board Association is doing to support our students. With that, I have public testifiers. Ray Parker, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hello. My name is Ray Parker. I'm from Rochester, Minnesota, and I'm testifying against HF Bill 564 due to its lack of specific language, which is appalling to me. Although admirable in its attempts to placate the public by adding this bill into law, there's nothing stating how much money will or could be appropriated to fund these mental health and behavioral issues. Who's deciding what constitutes these issues to be addressed? And who are they competing against to get this appropriated money? School districts, schools within a district, counties, cities. This appears to be another bill designed to look like it will benefit a group of people in desperate need of such funds, when in reality, those in need will likely never see any help by receiving what is dangled in front of them. You don't even specify who the school-linked mental health issues and behaviors are. Are they for students only, for teachers, for parents, for grandparents? And what are the determined treatments? Drugs? Isolation? Incarceration? Surgery? Euthanasia? Without specific language in place, this is too ambiguous and open for any interpretation the majority wants it to say. For instance, yesterday, pedophilia was a crime, and now you can't even say pedophilia. It's MAPS, because labeling them with that crime name might stigmatize them. Yesterday, complying to no prayer said out loud, today you can be jailed for just looking like you are in silent prayer. So again, who's defining the mental health issues and behavioral issues, and what treatment you'll be given?
I think we're I'm sorry to interrupt, but it feels like we're straying from the bill, Chair Noor.
That's correct, Chair Fisher. I was going to notify the testifier, please stay within the parameters of the bill that is discussing school-linked mental health, please.
Okay. Well, you know, a lot of it is targeting to propagandas that are being put forth in the schools. The extended distance learning was also identified in several areas as being part of this mental health issues. And without saying what you're doing specifically to give help to these children, without saying is it only students, is it the families, meaning teachers, parents, grandparents, it's too ambiguous. I say vote no. It's not ready for prime time. Thank you.
Thank you for coming to testify. The last on the list. If there's any other public testifier, please let me know. Anyone else? I would like to invite Christy Graham from the Department of Human Services to testify on this bill. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Christy Graham, and I'm with the Department of Human Services. So first, I want to extend a note of gratitude to Representative Bierman for being such a champion on this issue over the years, as well as to our partners and colleagues at the Mental Health Legislative Network and NAMI Minnesota, who have also really been important advocates in this endeavor. One of the foundational elements of the governor's and lieutenant governor's budget for 2023 was really to make sure that Minnesota is the best place for children to grow up in, whether they're black, brown, whether they live in greater Minnesota, urban parts of the state, suburban parts of the state. We really want to make sure that all children have opportunities to succeed. And so as part of that priority, one of our key investments is in the SchoolLink Behavioral Health Grant Program. So you'll see that reflected in our DHS budget recommendations. We've got $8.25 million investment in 24-25 and a $16.5 million investment in 26-27. We also have an investment in a similar grant program for the intermediate school districts, so those districts that serve students who have more challenges, and so we've got $8.8 million in each biennium ongoing added to the base for those grants as well. As has been noted today, Schooling Behavioral Health Grants are one of our most successful DHS grant programs. We have extraordinarily talented staff and policy experts at DHS that build partnerships and that really make this program so successful. It's received national accolades. I think we're in about 82% of school districts across the state right now, and we're serving just around 14,000 students per year. So it's a really impactful program. And we've heard today, and we know that there's workforce shortages, but we also know that children and families are really struggling right now, especially following the pandemic, where we're seeing increasing needs, increasing severity in needs. And so we really want to make sure that right now, especially at this moment in time, we're able to intervene and get people access to those services as quickly as possible. So we're really hopeful that members will support this legislation so we can continue to expand this important program, reduce those waiting lists, and really make sure that students and families have access to these life-enriching, oftentimes life-saving services. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much for your testimony. We now have member discussions. Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm trying to understand a little bit how this would interact with some of the special education districts. I was on the governing board of ZED, which was a cooperative effort between multiple small districts in rural Minnesota, which, you know, for special ed, gifted and talented, there were cooperative things of where they couldn't hire a 0.3 or a 0.25 position. So they got together, said the critical mass to be able to organize and deliver. And I wonder if that is taken into account when grants are put out, because you've got the criteria of highest percentages of special ed with emotional behavior disorders or high poverty. And, you know, having been involved, the need, especially in rural Minnesota where you've got the small schools, if you do it, you might have some schools that don't have the percentage and other schools that do, but you're cooperating to get a critical mass. And how are you going to treat that for grant prioritization?
Representative Bean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Kwong. I think that, the logistics of sorting that out as to where the funding goes based on need is paramount in how these grants are awarded. I don't have the granular details on how that is assessed, but I know that they are focusing on schools that have not been involved in the program previously, and also working to continue with those schools that have had it, and in multiple schools, multiple districts, trying to reach those students who may have been left out of the program for one reason or another, some of which you described. So I can get the department down here if we want to have a deeper dive on that, but that's what I know, is they're trying to make sure that the care gets out to where it needs to be, and that's the goal of the effort. We can bring someone down if you want more detail.
This bill will be coming back to us.
Mr. Chair, the point is that we really need some clarity, because the landscape is different in parts of greater Minnesota, mm-hmm. and we've got some non-standard ways of organizing for this type of support, and that's actual schools mm-hmm. organizing together. And so that's what I want to, one of the things that maybe they can give us some clarity later, not taking up the time now. But the other question I've got is on here, I'm familiar with districts where in Rochester, the parochial school was mainly in person. And I've had conversations with people with the Rochester School District that were quite a bit remote. And the exacerbation of some of the mental health concerns and issues because of those situations, looking at the language, I didn't see that is coming into some of the picking. If you're tied, that would be one of the things, at least secondary consideration to concern, because of, if you were had a year and a half of remote, you would be, and you had the same percentage of students in special ed or low income, you would have, I would think, a higher need than a district that was almost totally in person. We simplify in the bill, but I think there's a more complex terrain that we might have to give guidance in the final language. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Crum. Did you want to comment on that?
No, I think I understand the points that Representative Crum is making, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that, and that's the kind of detail that I would expect the Minnesota Department of Education and Health are looking at when they award these grants.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bierman, I really appreciate this bill. I actually got an email from some individuals in my community, and the number one need that they see is that the increase in this actually does allow them to go a little bit more out into greater Minnesota, into the rural areas. So I do like that they pointed out specifically in my community that's one of the areas that this would help fund. I do want to just pause for a minute and remind individuals who are listening, we have brought up that when we don't support or invest in mental health, that it can end in suicide. And anytime that we talk about that, I just want to remind people that 988 is a number that can be helpful if anybody is feeling suicidal or have those attempts. I want to highlight from a Minnesota lens why this is so important is that we actually we're higher than the national average for suicide in Minnesota. And so I think that absolutely we need to invest in these initiatives. And also it's the second leading cause of death for our kids. And so we do know that this is impacting us from border to border. And when we have horrific numbers like that, I think that this is absolutely the solution to things like that. And so I appreciate you bringing this forward and appreciate us making the space to talk about this. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Representative Gill. Next is Lead New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Bierman. I have two sort of questions for you. One, I'm wondering, the commissioner shall ensure grants are distributed to rural and urban counties. Typically, when we see language like this, there are numbers engaged. Like 40% of the grants would need to go to rural Minnesota. Is there a reason that you left that out of this language? The background is typically that language is usually included because otherwise rural counties get left behind. We just don't get the same funding that the urban counties get. So is there a reason that you specifically left that language out of this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative New Brindley, no reason specifically, but that's good data we should probably get and be aware of it so that we do know. And we may have it right now, if you would like to hear it. Otherwise, we can get it to the committee.
If we have the answer, we'll get back to the committee because this bill is coming back.
So, okay.
Lead New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And perhaps that's something we could consider adding into the language as this moves to ensure that those rural counties really are represented with this funding. The other question I have, and I know it's ticky-tacky, but I really get hung up on words. And on line 110, it says, at least 25% of the new funding must be targeted to providers that can serve schools that have the highest percentage, dot, dot, dot. That word can concerns me, because that just means that they're able to. It does not mean that they are compelled to. It doesn't mean that they must. It doesn't mean that they will. And so I would like to consider also if we can change that one word to ensure that these providers are serving schools that have these high rates of special education students. And, the reality is we talk about it a lot, but we talk about it because it matters. There's a lot of fraud in the system, and tightening up little things like that can help eliminate the potential and the possibility that the funds would be misused.
Mr. Chair, Representative Brindley, that's a good catch. That's something that we should look at as far as the language goes. And I know you get hung up on words sometimes, and I appreciate that. I've seen it numerous times in committee, so you're doing well on this. And the reason we come in before committees is to make bills better. So I appreciate your input on it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Bierman. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Chair Andor, and thank you, Representative Bierman, for bringing this forward. I know how important this is to make sure that we're better meeting the needs of our students throughout the state. My question's a little bit for the department here, because it's going to be kind of a technical one. The question I have is, I know that we're looking at a large increase here, and we're looking at probably working with organizations that they have not been working with before. And what I'm getting at is that there gets to be a cash flow situation where people are putting out the cash first and then for reimbursement. So I kind of want to know how the process is going to work for the granting, for the reimbursements, so that things are happening on a timely basis. Because if we're talking organizations out of state, they're probably smaller. They're going to be struggling to make sure that they're getting timely payments. Can you address that a little bit for us to make sure that we don't have people waiting for months to get payments?
Ms. Grant.
Mr. Chair, Chair Fisher, it's my understanding with this particular grant program that we have been able to do a pretty good job of making sure that people have the funding that they need to get those services delivered in a timely manner. I'm not sure of all of the specifics of exactly how people are reimbursed through the grant that way, but I can certainly follow up. It's also my understanding that we are looking to do with this bill potentially a request for information from providers and school districts to really understand who aren't we talking to right now and who might be interested in accessing some of this new money. So if there's potentially new smaller organizations coming on board, we want to really work across the state with all of our communities to understand who they are and what their needs are.
No, thank you. And that's part of the reason I'm asking, is because some of these small organizations may have a situation where they're going to have cash flow issues trying to do this. And these are the people that we really need doing the work. At the same time, I know with a number of the granting options in the past on different grants that DHS does, is that they are not able to put any of the money out until after expenses are incurred and documented. And that's why I'm raising the issue, is because we want to make sure we've got good accountability, but we want to make sure that these small organizations out there that want to do this work have that flexibility with the accountability built in. And that's why I'm raising the issue, to make sure that we're keeping that in mind as we're moving forward with this bill.
Ms. Graham, do you have any closing remarks on this?
Mr. Chair, Chair Fisher, I think that's an important point, and we'll certainly take that back to the team. I know we're actively looking as a department at procurement processes and requirements in general, and which of those requirements are items that maybe DHS imposed following, you mentioned integrity, but following audits, oftentimes those requirements come on, and which ones are maybe requirements through, you know, the Department of Administration, and what can we do to create more flexibility and nimbleness so that we can make sure that we're getting the money into the hands of people who need it.
Thank you so much. I think that's it from members, but I just wanted to note that this is really an important issue. Our schools are asking us to support them. As someone, you know, I had a child who had selective mutism. If that child didn't get the help within the school setting, it will have led to a difficult moment for her to continue with her education. Thank God we had school-linked mental health support in her school that will provide the services that the student needed. So this is a really important aspect, because our kids need to thrive in school, and the support that this bill will provide is critical for our schools within the state and supporting every kid in the state of Minnesota. So then I would like to give you your final remarks before I renew the motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the good conversation with members today, and I ask for your support for the bill.
With that, I renew my motion that House File 564 be re-referred to the Education Finance Committee as amended. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Seeing none, the motion prevails, and you are on your way to the Education Finance Committee. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The next bill is House File 586. Frederick, welcome. Welcome to the committee, and I will start by moving your House File 586 to be laid over for possible inclusion. With that, please introduce your bill and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. When it comes to the ranges of bills that we all carry, there's ones that are super passionate for us, and there's other ones that we see the good in that we carry. I would say this one is one that is absolutely one that I'm passionate about and believe in. Working in the human services field for as long as I have, and anyone that's done any legislative work in the space of human services, we all know that the need for mental health is real and growing, and that there's just not enough space for people to seek services. And so I'm super excited to be able to bring this piece of legislation forward that would try to help expand services available for those in greater Minnesota. What we see when people successfully complete their degrees and are looking to get a job, they go to where larger population centers are, and they expand their practice there. And I don't fault anyone for that, but it creates a need for us in greater Minnesota to be able to provide spaces for people to seek that care. What this legislation is looking to do is set up the first of its kind, that I'm aware of anyways, in the nation, a space that is similar to what we have in Mankato, and there may be in other universities as well, but the university has like a dental clinic. It's a space where people who are looking to become dental professionals tomorrow gives them a space to practice what they're learning, while at the same time a place to go for the community to go to receive services. And so this bill would do something very similar. It would set up a clinic in the community of Mankato that students there would be able to go practice what they learn under supervision, and it would give community members and people in the entire region a space to seek mental health care. It is not just a resource for Mankato. It is a resource for all of southern Minnesota. And I think the letters of support that are in the packet kind of emphasize that, because there's letters from NAMI, from the Minnesota Social Services Association, down to more local county level support, but even organizations like the pork producers are weighing in on this because they see the impact of having a space for our agricultural community to be able to go to seek that mental health care. And so I ask for the support of the committee, but at this point I would also like to turn it over to my testifiers who traveled up from Mankato today just for this.
Thank you so much, Representative Frederick, for bringing this bill forward. The first testifier is Mr. Shank. Welcome to the committee, and introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you so much for having me. I am Thad Shunkler. I'm an associate professor in the Department of Health Science at Minnesota State University. I'm also the founding director of the Center for Rural Behavioral Health. I'm a licensed mental health professional in the state of Minnesota. I hold two licenses, and I have a governor's appointment to the Board of Marriage and Family Therapy. My research over the past 8 years has been exclusively on behavioral health workforce issues. I'm a fellow of the National Rural Health Association and have been digging into the workforce challenges that we see here in Minnesota, particularly in outstate Minnesota. And what I want to talk to you about today is something that all of us can relate to. There's not a single person in this room that hasn't been impacted in some way, shape, or form of substance use and mental health challenges. These are stories that are dominating the news cycle. We see them every single day. But there's a story that's missing, and that story is who's going to provide this care. We just heard an excellent bill coming about how important care is, but where are the providers to provide that care? Just a couple of stats, I won't bore you with them, but according to federal data, 80% of Minnesota counties qualify as mental health provider shortage areas, many of them high needs provider shortage areas. Almost one-fourth or 25% of all mental health jobs in the state of Minnesota remain vacant as of today. That's Department of Health workforce data. This is coming at a time when our students have just told us in the student survey data that they're struggling. You know, nearly 30% of our young people are reporting long-term mental health challenges. It's coming at a time when farmer suicide rate is twice that of any other profession in the United States, and that's from the Centers for Disease Control. So What is the challenge here? How do we get more providers? That's what I've been focusing my work on. Just recently, we'll be coming out with a report with the Center for Rural Policy and Development on Monday that really dug into this issue. The timing's a bit off. I wish we could have released it in advance of this hearing, but it will be on your desk on Monday. And we asked that question. What is the challenge in growing the mental health workforce, particularly in outstate Minnesota? And one of the things that we did was we surveyed a number of the academic institutions that train mental health providers in the state, and we asked them, what are the limits? How come we're not getting more graduates in the program? And 40% of our respondents identified that there are not enough training sites. There are not enough sites to send their students to get the training they need to graduate and be eligible for licensure. 40% are saying that. We then followed up and said, just give us an estimate of how many students each year that are qualified for your program that you reject because of these capacity issues. And the number is approximately around 100 students. 100 students who want to be mental health professionals in this state can't because of capacity-related issues. Now, 100 doesn't sound like a lot, but if you live in Jackson County, where there's not a single licensed mental health professional, according to MDH data, that's a lot of people. That's a lot of future professionals. And so House File 586, what it does is it basically says, let's increase this capacity, and let's do it at an outstate institution who leads the state in graduating behavioral health providers. Currently, we have 5 programs that produce behavioral health professionals, and we send them all over the state, and they leave the south central region of our state. And what we know about research says the students tend to stay where they train. So we send them to the metro, and the metro keeps them at the time in which our community needs these resources. It's a double-edged sword in that this bill increases training capacity, but it also meets an unmet need in the Mankato region. The Greater Mankato United Way convened a group of stakeholders to ask this question: what does our community need? We recently had 2 suicides in our high school. Tragic. And what they found was that one of the greatest barriers to improving student in, you know, just emotional well-being is access. So this training clinic does both of these 2 things. It allows us to increase the number of providers we can train and put back out into our communities and meet a need in our communities. And we want to specialize that need on adolescents and the underinsured, the uninsured, and the medical assistance population, because those are the groups in our communities that are being least served. So I appreciate your consideration of this request, and I can tell you one thing. I spent a number of years in the military, and I don't fail, and the Center for Rural Behavioral Health's mission is to ensure every single Minnesotan, regardless of their zip code, can access mental health care when they need it, and we are going to do that, and I'm asking you to help and support us in a very innovative one-time investment way. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Associate Professor and Director. Thank you for your testimony. The next person I have is Emma Zelma. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Absolutely. Good afternoon, Chair Noor and representatives. My name is Emma Zelmer, and I represent the students of Minnesota State University Mankato as the student body president for this academic year. I am here on behalf of those 15,000 students today and with unanimous support of the 32 student government members at Minnesota State University Mankato to support House File 586 and the creation of a Center for Rural Behavioral Health Training Clinic. I want to discuss a little bit of what our senators discussed last night at our student government meeting. We passed it. Luckily, we were able to get it in your file on time. We talked a lot about the access of students. As Thad just shared with you, our students are not being able to be served on campus. A lot of our students get turned away if their cases are too great, if they need to be seen too often. A lot of times this leads to them not finding care and often needing to drop out of college and finish their degree or not finish their degree with college debt. By offering more mental health services on or near campus for our students and the community, that means our students will be able to finish their degrees and join the workforce with a full degree and hopefully a way to pay off their student loan debt. Beyond that, we also talked about the workforce development that this would be able to have for our graduate students on campus. As Thad shared, many students are not able to complete their graduate degree, whether they're not accepted or they are not able to fund it. This center would be able to fund graduate assistants who would have their tuition funded and receive a $10,000 stipend for their time working at the center. This is one of the most, one of the best ways for students to apply for grad school and find it paid for. As I'm looking at grad schools myself, the only schools that I'm looking at are ones that offer graduate assistantships that offer a full tuition stipend. Beyond that, something that surprised me a little bit, but not too much, was the focus on the rural area around Mankato. At Student Government, we take it very seriously, our duty to pay back the taxpayers who are helping fund a portion of our education. This means serving the community around Mankato and giving back. Being able to serve the community around Mankato that is historically underserved with mental health practitioners is a top priority of Mankato students. Personally, my Zelmer family has lived about 30 minutes outside of Mankato since 1860 when we were able to start a homestead, which my grandparents still live on today and my father was raised on. It was one of the reasons I chose Mankato because I could stay close to my grandmother's pantry, as well as I was able to visit home pretty frequently. But being able to make sure that my cousins who live right across the street from the farm my grandparents grew up on have access to mental health needs when they grow older is a top priority for me. And I urge you all, for our students and the rural Minnesotans that have been underserved for generations, to create a better future for tomorrow. So I urge you all, along with the 15,000 Minnesota State University Mankato students, to pass and allocate funding for House File 586. Thank you.
Thank you, President Zelmer. And we have the resolution, which was unanimous. I appreciate you including that in our package. So thank you so much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Do we have anyone in the public who wants to testify on this bill? See none. Member discussions. I have Lead New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Frederick. And frankly, Mr. Schunkweiler, I believe his name was, hit it right on the head. I get really frustrated when we just appropriate money thinking that that's going to solve a problem because, frankly, the people don't exist. You know, I mean, we all see the need in mental health, but we don't have the people. We don't have the bodies. So I feel like this is an actual solution to that problem. So thank you for that. My question is, and perhaps request, is on lines 118 through 120, you say upon request, the commissioner will make information available to us. I'm wondering if we can just remove the upon request. I think it would be really good and important for the legislature to hear from the commissioner what happens with this grant and the impact that it has.
Representative Frey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative New Brindley. I'm not opposed to that.
Thank you, Mr.
Lead New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Frederick. I really appreciate that. I always like that little accountability piece where we can see what's happening with what we're doing. And frankly, if we hear from the commissioner that this was really successful, there are a lot of other rural areas across the state that could use something similar.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and be nice if that was actually a small technical oral amendment and it was taken care of. I've got a little bit of question and some of the materials from the Center for Rural Behavioral Health. It indicates a disparity between urban and rural for a higher level of long-term mental health problems. And I'm curious if part of that is, you know, long-term might be because of the lack of access to treatment in the rural areas. And so that's why they have the more long-term, because if you live in a place where there's access, then you're getting treatment and it's not long-term because you got good treatment.
Director Schenkwein.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would concur with that. Academically, I would say that's a good hypothesis. The Minnesota Student Survey doesn't dig that deep into kind of those things, but I think your line of thinking is correct, that if you're not getting care, then those issues don't just resolve themselves. They end up persisting over time, and I always tell people, children and young people with problems become adults with problems. And we see now the consequence of suicide, overdose. These are all issues you can trace back to oftentimes children who are not getting the care that they need for these services. So I would concur with your assessment on the numbers are higher outside the metro, in part because of the overall lack of services.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I like that this bill is sort of addressing the problem, because the exacerbation of the situation in greater Minnesota is because I think you're not within reasonable access to not just clinics and professionals, but some of the organizations and nonprofits that have activities that the side effect is you feel less isolated, and it decreases some of the problems that then fester and cause the issues we see in greater Minnesota. So that I concur that we need to find out, the commissioner comes back or results come back to mm-hmm. us. You could always visit us sometime mm-hmm. In the future and let us know, out of this activity, we've discovered that these three things have a huge impact, and that's why we're increasing the accessibility of trained personnel to address that. And oh, by the way, if these areas and programs were funded or cross-pollinated, that would be assistance, because we sort of throw out money, try stuff, and it'd be real nice to say, okay, this was good, we're going to do more of it, this didn't work, oh, too bad, but now we'll go on to the next thing. And that's the kind of information I'd like. Thank you.
Yes, absolutely. I appreciate that, and I am committed to full accountability. I also, as a scientist, want to know, does this work? Because if it does, think of where else, not only in Minnesota, we could create these opportunities, but again, I'm a fellow of the National Rural Health Association. This is a problem everywhere across the country. And so, as Representative Frederick mentioned, we can really take an opportunity to lead the way in trying to solve some of these workforce provider shortage issues. And so I'm committed to full accountability of being able to report back how many more providers does Greater Minnesota have, in part because of our increased training capacities and recruiting students to our programs.
I have Vice Chair Bynum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the author for bringing this bill forward. Over the last couple of years, we have been hearing a great deal about some of the challenges in greater Minnesota, particularly a large increase in suicides among our agricultural community and some of the unique challenges that come with that. And in particular, I think it breaks down into two parts, in my estimation. And part of that is because, I will tell you in full disclosure, a good chunk of my family comes from northern Minnesota. And the first part is the one that you've already alluded to, is the people, right? So making sure that we have folks that are trained in and around that community, that are willing to stay in that community, that are enriching that community, that are building that base. But the other part that I'm a little bit concerned about, and I'm hoping maybe you could speak to it, either the author or maybe our testifier, but the other question is around stigma. And I think having a facility nearby is one good way to address and educate people about reaching out on mental health issues. But I know in a lot of communities across greater Minnesota, in northern Minnesota, good Scandinavians, Germans, you name it, who, we're tough, right? We are the descendants of potato farmers who came out of the famines, and we suck it up, right? We don't complain, we don't speak out. And so I'm curious if you could maybe address how this facility in specific might be able to be used to help overcome some of that stigma that we see in greater Minnesota, to really address those issues firsthand and address what I feel is a really tragic loss of life in greater Minnesota because these issues don't get addressed.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just want to say really quickly, I think the issue of stigma is a really valid one. As members of this committee and the members of the Human Services Policy Committee, we've heard that in committee, and it's really hard to hear from from students share that they can't access services because of stigma associated. Their parents don't believe that mental health is a thing, or you know, that their parents don't consent to mental health services because they think it brings shame to the family or something like that. So it's really hard to share their stories. I think ways that we combat stigma is, one, just having conversations about it, but then, two, having a public space, such as what we're trying to establish with this bill, I think helps also with that stigma, because people can see, oh, there's a space for us to go as a community, as a region, and that can still also then spur some of those conversations. But I would also like to invite the professor.
Director Shankwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate those comments. I do. And I'll just give an anecdote to Northern Minnesota. In our paper, what we did was we interviewed a number of community mental health centers, and I had the opportunity to chat with Anne-Marie Florist, who's at Range Mental Health. And we had this conversation around stigma. And the anecdote that she used is, how can we convince the people in our communities that this is important if they can't access it? That they have people who say, well, this is so important to talk about and to address, why can't I do it? It must not be that important. And so, I mean, that's just one example of those conversations of how we do reduce that stigma. The good news is that research is showing us that the younger generations who are calling out state and rural areas home are less, you know, stigmatized around mental illness. And I think even when you talk with parents and grandparents who still may have that, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps mentality, when you ask them about mental health, if you're talking about their children or their children's children, they are much more receptive. That stigma goes often out the window. So the good news is, with working on it, I concur with Representative Frederick's assessment. The more opportunities we have to talk about it, that the state of Minnesota is investing in this, I think it goes a long ways to try to reduce that stigma and get people help who need it, because this suicide rate among our agricultural community is not sustainable.
I just want to say thank you for that answer, and I really do appreciate that thoughtful answer. And I think the other part about this facility that I find really compelling is that we're talking about having a facility in and around a community where you have folks from the community who understand the community, who can speak directly to those individuals. And I think that also goes a long way into building those bridges. So thank you for the bill, and thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Chair Fry.
Yes, thank you, Chair Noor. And I think that this question is also to Dr. Schoenkweiler on the on kind of like how we're going from this one-time appropriation to this center that's going to turn out, you know, new providers, mm-hmm. which high needs, highly essential, and it's also going to be actually serving a population of people regardless of their ability to pay. And so that part of it is, so if it's only one-time money, mm-hmm. It sounds like it's not going to be so much hiring new people to be the teachers and the instructors, but just having been able to pull together the resources that already exist and focus them in a particular way so that we have this model new center. Mm-hmm. And so maybe if you can give a little bit more description about what exists right now, that the additional money will help pull together and focus. And then also, I think, to you know the line of questioning before, what we can learn from this that we could replicate in other places too. So in a way, this sounds like a pilot mm-hmm. For using existing resources in new and more powerfully focused ways.
Yeah, right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I'm understanding the question correctly, please correct me if I'm wrong, is how do I intend to sustain this after the appropriation is over? And that's always been the plan, is I look at this as a startup investment, and that before becoming an academic, I practiced clinically and ran a network of clinics, and so have a background in how do we establish this. It will be sustained in most part through that third-party reimbursement rate. Many of our community providers are unable to make ends meet when we're talking about billing medical assistance, because they're having to pay someone like me a whole lot more than I will have to pay a graduate assistantship. And so the margins make it work a whole lot easier. In addition to that, there are a number of federal funds and state funds that currently exist, grants and different things that are out there to help us sustain this model. I just flew in from Washington this morning. I was out meeting with the Minnesota delegation talking about increasing some of the mental health appropriations. So a clinic like mine, if we're able to be established, can sustain itself through more viable funding. Because I don't want to come back and say, hey, I need more to go.
Chair Pratt.
Thank you.
Just the one quick question for Director Shankwell. You know, the demographics is also changing in rural areas in greater Minnesota. Will you be able to accommodate, you know, students with different backgrounds who are able to serve the communities around the area?
Mr. Chair, that's a great question, and I'm glad that you asked it because I wanted to answer this. We want to be intentional of the students that we recruit into behavioral health programs. There are two types of students that I focus on recruiting. One are students from rural communities, so they can go back and practice in those communities. It's hard to transplant someone from Edina to New Ulm or, you know, in those other smaller communities. But if they're from those communities, there's a much greater chance that they'll go home and practice. We also need to do a much better job of diversifying the behavioral health workforce. Approximately 90% of all of what I do are white individuals. And so we want to be intentional about recruiting students of color and from diverse backgrounds so we can grow that part of the workforce as well. And Minnesota State is a great place to do that with the number of diverse students that we have. And so I'm very excited about that opportunity for our community that lacks a cultural representation in the providers that we have. And I believe our graduate students can do that.
Thank you. With no further discussion, I wanted to go back to the request from Lead New Bend. I think you wanted to do a small oral amendment to the bill. I think the author of the bill, if he doesn't have any objection, we can ask Lead New Bend to give us an oral amendment, and I'll ask to be if we can make that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if the author is open to that, I would amend on line 1.18 to delete the words upon request and the comma and capitalize the word the.
You summarized very well. So there's an oral amendment offered by Lead New Brindley. I would like to get the nonpartisan staff just to make sure that we are doing it correctly and to reflect the change requested.
Mr. Chair, members, that is correct. The amendment would be on page 1, line 18, delete upon request, comma.
Any discussion on the amendment, the oral amendment? See none. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? See none. The motion prevails. The amendment, the oral amendment is now adopted. To your closing remarks as the amended bill.
Thank you, Ms. Chair and committee members. I appreciate the conversation and support today. To Representative Quam's statement earlier, I really do hope that this can be a story of success that we can replicate in other communities. And I think this is the first step to finding that out. So thank you for your comments and your support. And thank you to the committee.
Thank you so much, Representative Frederick. So I renew my motion that House File 586 as amended to be laid over for possible inclusion. With that, we move to the next bill, House File 988. Representative Ryan, welcome to your committee, and please move the bill and proceed with your introduction of the bill.
Thank you, Chair Noor and committee members. I'm here to talk today about House File 988. It's a bill that provides ongoing funding for the Rare Disease Advisory Council.
So you wanted to move the House File.
Sorry, I sure do. Yes, please.
So you, Representative Ryan moves House File 988 be laid over for possible inclusion. With that, please proceed.
I'll continue right where I was. The bill appropriates $647,000 in fiscal year 2024 and $586 in fiscal year 2025 for the Rare Disease Advisory Council. The ongoing annual base will be about $600,000 per year. This will fund four FTEs as well as operational and program costs. The budget was developed with assistance from the Minnesota Council on Disabilities, and the FTEs were compared with two other state agencies of similar scope and size, the Minnesota Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans and the Minnesota Commission on the Deaf, Deafblind, and Hard of Hearing. I've been working on legislation for the council since 2021, and I'm excited to see it obtain the funding needed to fully deliver on its important mission. I'm also very pleased to have bipartisan co-authors in both bodies. Now I'd like to turn it over to my testifiers to bring the work that the council does to life for you so that you understand what we will be funding and the benefits that it brings. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I have Erica Burns, Executive Director. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Noor and Human Services Finance Committee members. I'm Erica Barnes. Thank you so much for letting me speak to you today. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Rare Disease Advisory Council and mother to Chloe Sophia Barnes, who passed away from a rare disease in 2010. For the past 12 years, I've worked in advocacy and nonprofit on behalf of the rare disease community, and it's an honor to present to you today. When people hear the term rare disease, they often assume that the disease affects only a small portion of society. And while this is true when each rare disease is considered individually, when the over 7,000 different rare diseases are considered collectively, they affect 1 in 10 of the population. Individuals can be affected in a myriad of ways by their rare diseases. They may be born with skin so thin, like my friend Mohammed, and student at the University of Minnesota, that they're referred to as butterfly children, and they live in constant pain from the lack of skin. Or they may, like Rare Disease Advisory Council member Ray Blalark's son, have a disease that affects the biochemistry of the sickle cells that can lead to organ damage, swelling, stroke, and again, chronic pain. Still others, like my daughter Chloe, might be born apparently happy and healthy, but eventually lose the ability to walk, talk, swallow, and eventually breathe on her own. But in spite of these varying symptoms, there is one thing that nearly all individuals with rare diseases have in common, the strikingly similar barriers to care that anyone diagnosed with a rare disease faces. These barriers include extreme delay in diagnosis. It takes an average 7 to 8 years for an individual with a rare disease to be diagnosed. Difficulties identifying a clinician with expertise to treat an individual rare disease. This often leads to relocation to a new city or even a new state in order to receive care, and significant disparities in treatment options. You see, only 5% of all individuals with a rare disease have access to an FDA-approved treatment. It was the recognition of the lack of equitable care for the rare disease patient population that motivated a 42-member coalition to call for the creation of the Minnesota Rare Disease Advisory Council in 2019. Our council's vision statement is this: we envision a world where every Minnesota citizen living with a rare disease has access to a timely diagnosis, comprehensive care, and an effective treatment. One of our council members, Dr. Berkowitz, will speak in a few moments to talk about the work that he's been doing and the council has been doing over the last few years. In closing, I want to leave you with this quote from Abby Myers, who founded the National Organization for Rare Disorders and is a mother of a son with a rare disease. Families affected by rare diseases represent a medically disenfranchised population that falls through the cracks of every healthcare system in the world. By funding this council, we can ensure that no one is an afterthought in our healthcare system, no matter how rare their disease. Thank you.
Thank you so much. We're sorry for your loss, and also thank you so much for sharing your story with all of us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
The next person is Dr. Sheldon Berkowitz. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Chairman Noor, thank you for allowing me to testify today in support of HF 988. My name is Dr. Sheldon Berkowitz. I am a recently retired pediatrician, past president of the Minnesota chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, and current member of the Rare Disease Advisory Council, having been on the council since its start in 2019. I'm also the lead for the Transition and Coordination of Care Workgroup of the council. As a pediatrician at Children's Minnesota for the last 20 years of my career, I routinely saw patients and families with rare diseases. For me, seeing these patients was an everyday experience. However, I can tell you that for most pediatric and adult primary care clinicians in community practices, caring for a patient with a rare disease is in fact a rare experience, one that they often feel ill-equipped to deal with. Some rare diseases, such as sickle cell disease or cystic fibrosis, may be well known, while others, such as Pompe disease, are not. Our council is attempting to provide support both for the patients, families, and clinicians to improve the care being provided. To help in this work, our work group has been involved in three main efforts. First is the development of a network or directory of clinicians willing to care for patients with rare diseases. This network would help pediatric primary care clinicians caring for patients with these diseases to find adult primary care clinicians willing to take on their patients when they age out of their pediatric practice. The lack of adult clinicians willing to care for these patients is currently a major issue in transitioning these patients. It would also allow any primary care clinician to connect with a specialist to either help care for or diagnose their patient with a rare disease. Being able to connect with colleagues with more knowledge about rare diseases will provide the clinician with tools to better care for their patient. We are still in the early stages of developing this directory, and our proposed funding would help pay for a project manager to oversee this project. Second, over the past year, we coordinated with Gillette Children's Hospital, the Minnesota Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, and the Minnesota Department of Health to host a roundtable event looking at systems barriers to effective transition. This very successful event last June resulted in hundreds of patients, families, clinicians, patient advocacy groups, and health system representatives from across the state and country coming together to discuss the systems barriers and propose solutions. A summary paper will be coming out shortly, and our plan is to share it widely, including with health systems and health plans. Finally, our work group assisted the Minnesota Medical Association and Gillette Children's Hospital in obtaining a grant to fund an echo learning collaborative project to help adult clinicians feel more comfortable in accepting pediatric patients with complex healthcare needs into their adult practices. Next steps and possible future projects to allow clinicians to share their expertise with one another in informal settings will be discussed at a summit next month, which one of our work group members is helping to plan. Our work group and council's goals in all these projects is to improve the care of all the patients and their families in our state with a rare disease, and I hope you will support the requested funding so that we can continue this important work. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Bukowicz, for your testimony. Appreciate it and the work that you've been doing. Any member of the public who wants to testify on this bill? Anyone? To member discussions. Chair Pryor.
Thank you, Chair Noor. I had the honor of having Erica Barnes in my office quite a few years back when you were starting this, and I'm so grateful that it did get funded, and I know that this is just essential that we continue it. I remember hearing this bill last year or the year, I can't remember exactly, and then you come to the conclusion rare diseases are rare individually but common as a population. And so all of us will have a family member or a friend or someone that we know that has a rare disease, and the barriers are the same for all of them, and that we have to keep working on this. And so I thank Representative Ryer for sticking with this one and making sure that we stay forward, and I know that you'll be committed to it. And I guess I just have to, one of those, we know that this is one of the stories where out of the greatest tragedy a parent can experience, you know, you bring us light and hope, and we're just honored to be with you again today. So thanks for keep coming back and always keep coming back and letting us know what we can do to make this work for kids mostly, but also for all those adults too. So that's it. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. I was sitting in this room when actually we approved the first motion to get going with the Rare Disease Council. As I served in Human Services, and I appreciate the work that you've done so far in addressing some of the challenges that we're all facing. Just wanted to check in, what is the current funding level in our, we have our fiscal staff, Mr. Burke, if you can just take, what is the current?
Mr. Chair, for the 22-23 biennium, originally the legislature appropriated $300,000, $150,000 a year, and it was at the University of Minnesota. Last year, we transferred the unspent funds to the Council on Disability as the agent, fiscal agent for the council. the amount that moved was 287,000 of the original 300,000. But the original appropriation was only, it was one time only, so the council has no base at this point. The governor does, however, have a recommendation to create a base and have the council move forward. So there's no base for next year, but the governor does fund it.
Absolutely. So I just wanted to note that, and so we would like to make sure that we continue with the great work that the rare, you know, disease council has been doing. Any closing remarks, Representative Bryan?
Thank you for your support. I appreciate the work the council does and eager to see it move forward with some stability so that they can plan and take action. Thank you.
With that, Representative Bryan renews her motion. House File 988 be laid over for possible inclusion. Members, that concludes the agenda for today. With no further items before us, we're now adjourned.